well, may not be the best solution. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble Labor reporter Kia Lucero joins Jason Foster to discuss the design flaws and shortcomings of the Public Sector Compensation Transparency Act and Sunshine Lists in Alberta. Here are Lucero and Foster in conversation. Take a listen.
Thank you so much for joining me on Rabble Radio today, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
And just to get started, can I get you to introduce yourself?
Well, so I'm Jason Foster. I'm the director of Parkland Institute based at the University of Alberta, and I'm also an associate professor of human resources and labor relations at Athabasca University.
So today we'll be talking about Sunshine Lists and the Public Sector Transparency Act. Before we dive into that, can you please tell me a little bit of background on Sunshine Lists and the Public Sector Transparency Act?
Yeah, so, I mean, Sunshine Lists are something that sort of started to emerge in Canada kind of in the late 90s, started off in Ontario under Mike Harris, and is kind of basically now in every jurisdiction in the country, where essentially there's an act that requires that public sector employees whose salary and compensation generally is over a certain threshold, their name and salary will be published once a year. And so that's kind of sort of the broad history of it. And the Public Sector Compensation Transparency Act in Alberta is currently up for review. It dates back to 2015 under the NDP government of Rachel Notley. And so it's been about 9 years since it's been in place. And so the legislature is doing a bit of a review of it. And so we as Parkland Institute decided to just do a little bit of digging into how effective this is and what could be done to make it more in alignment with the public interest. And maybe we can talk about this in more detail. I think it's important to acknowledge that Sunshine Lists, the origin of Sunshine Lists, comes out of the right? The sort of various AstroTurf groups on the right, like the Canadian Taxpayers Federation and Canadian Federation of Independent Business, were the people kind of pushing for this initially as a way to try and, you know, shed the light on those, you know, big outrageous salaries that bureaucrats make. But I think those of us sort of a more progressive bent, there can be a value in this as long as they're shaped and designed in a proper way, that it creates accountability where accountability needs to be created without violating the privacy of ordinary frontline workers.
And can you give me an example of that? I was reading a little bit about on Parkland Institute's blog. I saw that your blog on Sunshine Lists, there was an AHS executive leader that was found to have had like an exorbitant amount of compensation and a bunch of things on the side. Do you mind expanding on that a little bit more?
Happily. I mean, the origins of the PSCTA, the Public Sector Compensation Transparency Act, it's a mouthful, it comes out of, in the early 2010s, there was a whole series of scandals about being revealed that senior government officials and, you know, heads of agencies and boards and the such getting absolutely outrageous contracts, you know, high salaries, you know, outrageous perks like car allowances and their memberships to private golf courses being paid for. And so it just was, you know, it kind of created a bit of a public outcry. And so the example that you're thinking of was a vice president of Alberta Health Services, which is our sort of centralized delivery of healthcare. They walked away in 2012 with $730,000 in severance, having only been in the job for less than 18 months. And so that's the kind of thing that kind of led to the outrage that kind of said, wait a minute, we need more accountability and transparency in these kinds of higher end deals. Like, you know, another example would be the Workers' Compensation Board, where around that time, the CEO of the Workers' Compensation Board was making, all in, making $600,000-$800,000 a year. And this is money that could have been going to injured workers, but instead was going into the pockets of the CEO. And so that was part of what this act was designed to try and sort of help shed more light on those kinds of excess.
And I just want to make sure, is this like public taxpayer money that's going into lists?
So the list involves public sector employees. And so in one way or another, there is public sector, you know, public taxpayer dollars affected. I mean, in the case of WCB, of course, that's employer premiums, as opposed to taxpayers' dollars, but still the WCB mandate, right, to provide appropriate compensation to injured workers. So they have a public obligation. So in many ways, this is about trying to sort of recognize that taxpayers' money is not being lavishly thrown around to these high-level executives.
Yeah, as you mentioned, earlier this year, I think about April 15th of 2024, you spoke in front of the Legislative Assembly of Alberta in its review of the Public Sector Transparency Act. So you noted that these disclosures were meant to serve public interest. But from what Parkland Institute and what you have found, what have you observed overall?
Well, I think we sort of recognize the need to create transparency around these senior level executives, right? And it's in the public interest to have the public know how their money is being spent in that way. What we observed, though, in our analysis of the legislation was that it has a key design flaw. Its primary mechanism is it just creates financial threshold. And if you make more money than that threshold, you're on the list. It doesn't matter who you are, right? And so when I did a review, for example, of the 2022 disclosure list for Alberta Health Services, it had about roughly 2,300 people on the list. At that point, the threshold was $141,000 for AHS. So that meant, you know, there were about 2,300 people making more than $141,000 in 2022. On that list was 884 registered nurses, right? And another 112 paramedics. And when I saw that, something went off in my head, right? It's like, wait a second, right? I mean, what that's all that tells us, you know, we get the name of this nurse who, you know, happened to make enough of money. If you think about a nurse, right, they get paid by the hour, which means the only way they can make it onto the sunshine list is to just work a whole whack of overtime, right? And so is it really in the public interest to learn the name of a nurse who pulled down some night shifts and over in double shifts, right? Because for whatever personal reasons they may have had, including necessity because our healthcare system is understaffed. And so we just sort of realized there's a huge difference between highlighting, you know, the salary of the president of AHS, which in the same year, by the way, was $661,000, versus revealing the name of a frontline healthcare worker who happened to just, earn a lot of overtime. So we've seen that there was a failure in the design of the legislation in terms of being able to focus its attention where it needs to be focused, and it was unnecessarily scooping up, you know, a frontline workers and invading their privacy, quite frankly. And we couldn't see any real public interest that was being served in doing so. And so that was one of our recommendations to the committee was to fix that particular problem.
I think you noted this earlier too, nurses and public sector workers such as nurses and paramedics, they're under collective bargaining agreement wages and stuff. So that's, I think that's important to note as well, that they're already on like a contract, I guess I'm trying to say.
Yeah, that was the core of our recommendation, right? We basically were recommending that workers whose compensation is determined by the collective bargaining process, through a collective agreement, should be exempted from the disclosure requirements of the Act. And the argument is quite simple. If I'm the CEO of Alberta Health Services, I sit down and I negotiate my contract, right? And I have full range in terms of I'll use whatever bargaining power I've got to get as good a deal for myself as I can possibly get. If a worker has a collective agreement that they're under, they have no control over what actually happens in terms of their pay and conditions, aside from their democratic participation in their union. And so because they have no negotiating capacity, why are we subjecting them to this invasion of privacy when there's nothing, they have no latitude to change? They can't cut themselves a sweetheart deal, right? They're just getting what every other worker is getting that has been duly negotiated through the collective bargaining process, and that's a fair process. I mean, we also highlight that collective agreements are public. So the public can already go in and find out what an hourly wage for a nurse is. And so it's already perfectly transparent to Albertans and to Canadians in their various jurisdictions what these workers make. And so there's no need to individually name a worker who just happened to bump across that financial threshold.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for clarifying that too. I think that's definitely an important distinction in terms of public sector worker versus those high level executives, for instance. Are there any possible outcomes that come from disclosing this personal information of like these public sector workers, like in a negative light or anything? What are those outcomes?
Yeah, no, that is actually one of the reasons why we sort of kind of look at this, because when you post someone's name, on, you know, on a public web saying that they make X amount of dollars. There's a number of potential consequences for that individual, right? And we've heard reports from workers who, you know, people can target them, right, for financial scams, and people, you know, they're suddenly their neighbors know exactly how much they make, which is, can be kind of embarrassing. And even in cases, for example, if there's a custody battle during a divorce, that kind of information can be used, you know, appropriately or inappropriately by the other, you know, the other spouse, you know, to try and affect the outcomes of that case. And so there's just this sort of invasive that just seems kind of unnecessary, that it could have these negative consequences for people in their communities. Should people find out? And there's really, as I say, there's no real justifiable gain for the public to know that person's salary.
And I guess on the other side of it, I guess it's pretty obvious to me and you, but what's a justifiable reason to holding these high-level executives and having their salaries? Can we just explain that a little bit more, having that publicly disclosed?
Yeah, and I think that's a fair question, right? And I think it goes down to the role that these officials play. They make decisions that impact hundreds of thousands of people every day, right? They are the senior leaders who are guiding public policy, guiding the delivery of public services, and they're making key decisions. And so obviously it's important that they be fairly compensated. But because of their positions of authority and the position that they're in, they have undue bargaining power. Right? They have more bargaining power than an average worker has. And so they can use that to their advantage to get special perks and extra compensation and bonuses and severance packages that an average worker just has no access to. And so because this is tax dollars, and it's tax dollars that, you know, we want directed to those key public services, I think the public has a right to know what portion of those tax dollars are being spent on a handful of senior executives who can negotiate these deals behind closed doors. So it's a way of kind of shedding a little sunlight on what those deals look like, and hopefully then changing sort of our, you know, giving the public a role in articulating expectations about what we consider to be fair compensation for the CEO of Alberta Health Services, or the CEO of the Workers' Compensation Board, or, you know, the Deputy Minister of Finance. So that, you know, it's a way of just making sure that the public can weigh in on what are key decision makers' positions, who are in a position to be able to abuse the trust that Albertans give them if they're not, you know, not made to transparent.
Perfect. Kind of hence the name Sunshine List, I suppose.
Yeah, and again, you know, the name is a bit problematic in the sense that this came out of right-wing advocates who kind of saw it, oh, we're going to shine light on government largesse and excess, right? But just because they have a, you know, they want to use a sledgehammer for this particular policy problem, you know, there is a way to kind of do this in a more finessed fashion that actually helps achieve public accountability without unduly negatively impacting regular workers.
Absolutely. And you did mention, you mentioned one of the recommendations. I'd be curious to know what the other two recommendations you proposed to legislative.
Yeah, so the central one was this recommendation to exempt those who were covered by a collective agreement from the provisions of the Act. One of the other recommendations we made was to add a preamble to the Act, articulating very clearly what the purpose of the Act is. And in that, it can be acknowledged that that is a fairly cosmetic change, but what we noticed is that even it's only been in place for 9 years, already people have kind of forgotten why we instituted it in the first place, right? They've already forgotten that this came out of a bunch of scandals about excess, you know, contracts for senior officials. And so, like, for example, in the committee that we presented to, we had both, you know, government and opposition members on it. There was only one MLA who was an MLA at the time when this act was introduced. And so it just made it clear to me that we need to remind the public and legislators going forward about what this act is about, so that A, it doesn't overreach and start scooping up workers it shouldn't scoop up, and B, to remind us that there is a public interest to be served by making sure there's transparency around the compensation of senior executives, right? And just as a quick anecdote for why we need to be mindful of that, is not this time, but the last time that this gap was up for review, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation was proposing lowering the threshold to a figure that would have scooped up probably half of the public servants in the province. And that's the kind of excess that we want to make sure doesn't happen. And then the third recommendation was one where we recognize where, again, the Act has fallen short. When you offer up this kind of transparency potential, there is the potential to also advance issues of equity. If we had a little bit more information about who those individuals are in terms of how they identify, that could give us tell us a little bit more about how well is the government of Alberta moving towards issues of pay equity, whether it be racialized workers or women. And so we have no capacity to do that now because it's just a name and a job title, right? And obviously, trying to determine someone's ethnicity or gender by their name is a very problematic exercise. So we just kind of propose trying to find a mechanism that would allow us to also advance equity issues amongst the senior leadership of the Alberta government.
Great thing to bring up, I would say, in terms of that. And say if that data was available to research institutes like Parkland, how would you use it to study pay equity among public servants? And what do you think would come out of it, I guess?
Well, I mean, one of the things we've long known when looking at issues of pay equity is that until the information is known, you can't fix it, right? It's only when we realize, through research and through the disclosure of salary information that in most workplaces, women make less than men, right? That racialized workers make less than non-racialized workers. And so if you put that information out there and say, wow, isn't it interesting that the male deputy ministers are making, and this is just a number out of, we don't have this data, but say they're making 15% more than the female deputy ministers, right? Suddenly it becomes a very stark problem that you can then take steps to address. And that's why that kind of information is always important. We've known that every across all jurisdictions, when we look at pay equity and issues of pay equity, the first step has to be full disclosure about who's getting paid what, so that you can then figure out where the inequities are.
So I guess along with the Public Sector Transparency Act, the NDP government at the time also introduced the Reform Agencies, Boards and Commissions Compensation Regulation Act. Can you tell me a little bit about this act? Because I know it was repealed back in December of 2023 and want to hear your thoughts on that too. But maybe we'll start with the background first.
Sure. And I think this is actually maybe a really a good way to end because, a discussion about sunshine lists, one of the main shortcomings of this particular legislative approach is that all it does is make the information known. So it doesn't actually make anybody stop getting sweetheart deals, right? It just makes that sweetheart deal public, right? So it's a key shortcoming as a policy tool. I mean, it's useful as far as it goes, but that would be a problem. And so if we look at what the other piece of the puzzle when the NDP government introduced the Sunshine List, they also created an act that regulated how non-union senior officials could be compensated. And so it basically put in sort of pay ranges so that they would have to work within a certain range of salary, forbid, car allowances and golf cart memberships, and it put strict rules around how big the severance package could be. And so it actually went in and said, okay, we're not just going to tell the public what all the deputy ministers and CEOs of agencies are making. We're actually going to control what they can actually negotiate. And so I actually think that that piece of public policy, that legislation, is far more important in terms of being able to curb excesses of these kinds of sweetheart deals, because it actually just kind of makes them not possible. And so what's interesting that the UCP last December made a decision to repeal that act. And so what that leaves us now, and they've replaced it with a system where the Minister of Finance gets to decide who gets paid what. What contracts are acceptable to negotiate and what are not, which just recreates this problem all over again. So now we're getting deals cut in the back room between the Minister of Finance and the CEO of Alberta Health Services or whatever its successor is going to be, and where there's no rules or regulations or boundaries around what they can negotiate, which allows them to bring in those, sort of gold-plated severance packages, little special perks. And so that's highly problematic. The elimination of that act is actually quite problematic, because I think it was a really key component in curbing the excesses of these kinds of sweetheart deals.
Like, in terms of currently in Alberta, public sector workers, like teachers included, nurses, paramedics, everything, all the public sector workers are continuously bargaining for a fair wage deal. And knowing that there's these excess of money being given to these high-level things, how do you think that actually affects, like, these frontline workers?
Well, it would rightfully anger them, right? It really speaks so much about the priorities of the government when, on one hand, they're saying to frontline workers, we can't afford to give you any pay raises, right? Like, you know, the public sector workers in the last, you know, 8-9 years have received almost nothing in pay increases. And so they're being told, and they're being told once again, even though we're in a period of high inflation, the government's saying, we have no money for it. We can't give you a big pay raise. And so they're doing that with their doctors, also with their nurses and their teachers and their park rangers and the like. But then they'll turn around and they'll negotiate a deal with the CEO of Alberta Health Services that gives them this big, fat compensation package. I think it speaks volumes about where their priorities are. If I were a frontline worker and I see the kinds of deals that they're negotiating, I would be angry. And I think I would have damn good reason to be angry.
That's all the time we have for today, Jason. I just want to thank you again for taking the time to chat with me today.
My pleasure. I'm happy to chat anytime.
Thank you so much.
That was Rabble Labor reporter Kia Lucero and the director of Parkland Institute, Jason Foster, in conversation. Thanks so much for that, Kia and Jason. Switching gears now, it's time for a segment we like to call In Case You Missed It. And for that, we'll turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. This week in labor news, the Ontario Federation of Labor rallied alongside students encamped on the University of Toronto campuses. The students are protesting as a part of a global movement at university campuses across North America, calling for post-secondary institutions to divest themselves from Israel. The movement opposes investment in Israel because of the ongoing attack against Gaza and the long-standing oppression of Palestinians. Laura Walton, the president of the Ontario Federation of Labor, has been unequivocal in her organization's support of the student movement. In a public statement, Walton criticized the University of Toronto's request to have police clear the encampment. The statement reads in part, quote, "Universities should be where we learn to debate and disagree with each other without the fear of violence. For Canada's largest university to decide unilaterally when the debate should end and when police repression should begin is a betrayal of the values we claim to uphold," end quote. In national news, Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre is under pressure to denounce the Liberals' planned increase of the capital gains tax. Poilievre usually vehemently opposes any proposed tax increase, but has been silent on the issue of the capital gains tax. Under the Liberal plan, the capital gains tax would be applied to 2/3 of revenue from the sale of assets valued over $250,000. Speculation that Poilievre has been quiet on the issue of the capital gains tax is that it is widely popular and it would only affect a small number of Canadians. Poilievre, while a conservative, likes to brand himself also as a populist. That being said, a contingent of his party's traditional supporters would like to see him oppose this tax hike. In tech news, AI programs like ChatGPT can be handy when writing up resumes or product descriptions for websites. But how and what these programs learn can perpetuate state oppression, as Miriam Andrangi described this week in an op-ed for Rabble. Andrangi asked ChatGPT questions about the RCMP's Community Industry Response Group. This task force was created by the RCMP to respond to growing protests in BC opposing projects that threaten the environment, such as logging and pipelines. Andrangi found that when asked about the Community Industry Response Group, ChatGPT tended to gloss over instances of violence perpetrated by members of the task force against peaceful protesters, and emphasized the importance of protecting corporate property. This is just one example of how designers of these programs, like ChatGPT, can ingrain pro-corporate and pro-police biases into systems that are used by an unsuspecting public. And finally, in environmental news, David Suzuki is warning about the lack of balance when it comes to exploiting our natural resources. The federal and provincial governments claim that they try to balance the forests that they set aside for logging with considerations for the need to preserve habitat for wildlife. But Suzuki says that time and again, more gets taken for consumption than is left behind for nature. To read the full version of all the stories we talked about today, please visit rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
Good morning, it's Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby. We just danced our way awake with Soul Makassa.
Yeah, I'm a young black man who uses art to champion and celebrate blackness, as well as creating art that showcases black men as comprehensive, emotionally intelligent human beings.
Right now, we are going to hear a spoken word rap piece by slam poetry winner JB, the First Lady. That is Lady Johnny Proby singing Don't Quit, and here at Speak Up, we do not quit. Love, laughter, argument, and encouragement. The words are too few for the essence of you. And it shows just one of the ways that you can take feelings of pain and transform them to love and recognition. Today, we're exploring senior issues through digital media and the creative arts. My guests are Leslie Riemann, the director of the 411 Center, and Joel Flynn from Podstream. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, welcoming you to the Friday Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You've Heard show. We have conversations about social issues, culture, and creative arts events, potent samplings about special months like Health Month, Black History Month, Women's Month, Nutrition Month, and more. See you Friday at 10 a.m.